This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Efficiency is definitely key when you're dealing with 8 million last-minute Christmas shoppers.
Problem is, I end up wrapping presents Christmas morning, which is really not that fun.
Now, here's your host.
Hi, this is your host, Dara Z. Handelar of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Sitting in for Mike Petrelli, who is at his son's very first parent-teacher conference. Good luck. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, Michael Brickman.
I haven't done the parent-teacher conference thing yet. That's scary future. You know?
I've been on the giving end as the teacher, but not yet as the parent. So, Michael, front page news of the Washington Post this week is that stores are now open not only on Black Friday, but actually on Thanksgiving. Are you an early Christmas shopper or a last minute kind of guy?
Well, Hanukkah aligns with Thanksgiving this year, so maybe helping out us Jews to get our Hanukkah shopping.
Actually, that's a good point. And this year, with Hanukkah falling so early, there's no way that I'm going to be ready to give presents. And we can't take advantage of the Black Friday or Christmas sales. So I guess we're full price.
Yeah, just another reason where Hanukkah gets screwed over by Christmas.
Yeah, but our food is awesome. Yeah. The Christmas songs are way better. Yeah, I have no qualms about that.
There may be some really good Hanukkah songs that are in Hebrew. Translation doesn't really work. And
I would like to hear that. I challenge any of our listeners to send us a good Hanukkah song, because in my mind, they all suck. All right. And on that note, let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, question number one.
In a report released Wednesday, the Friedman Foundation argued that when parents are choosing a private school within a voucher or tax credit scholarship program, student performance on standardized tests is one of the least important pieces of information to them, and that as such, public officials should, quote, resist the temptation to impose national or state standards and testing on private schools. In this case, will the market suffice?
Well, I think that the first part of what you said and the second part of what you said of the question do not necessarily follow from one another. So it is not necessarily surprising that parents who are choosing private schools aren't prioritizing standardized test scores, right? This is what we found in our What Parents Want report, which covered all types of parents, private school parents, charter school parents, public traditional public school parents. And I think that there almost is an implication or an assumption from parents that private schools are high quality and they're choosing a private school for other factors, for factors other than their core set of instructions. But to say that that means that private schools don't need academic standards and standardized testing when they're receiving public money is not, I don't think, a valid conclusion that follows from things that parents might not value the scores, because if you're spending public money on this, then you need to have some sort of quality assurance, even if the parents themselves aren't paying attention to it.
So I agree for the most part, and I'm glad you brought up the What Parents Want study, because if you look at that study and then look at what the parents in this Friedman Foundation evaluation said, really, it's pretty similar. You know, they wanted some of the basic things that they felt they weren't getting in the public schools. They wanted safety. They wanted assurance that they're actually getting some degree of individual attention from their teachers. And so I think that was the reason they chose to exercise choice. Now, I also agree that there needs to be some sort of, if there's public money going to these things, some sort of protection to make sure that students are actually learning. And also, I do think that the very worst schools, there needs to be some sort of kind of protection in place where the very worst schools of any kind, traditional public, charter, voucher, schools that receive public money that are terrible, I don't think should be getting a whole lot of cash from the taxpayers. But that doesn't mean they should be imposing all sorts of mandates and input-focused things where the schools basically end up looking like public schools.
Agreed. I think it's just one case among many that really pushes for smart accountability systems, for a little bit of flexibility in accountability systems that I'm pretty sure Mike would agree with, but not a complete moratorium on accountability systems for any type of school of choice, whether we're talking about private schools, charter schools, whatever, if you are receiving public money. Because in a private school that receives public money, it's not just the parents at that school that have the right to hold the school accountable. It's the taxpayers as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Question number two.
The DC Charter Board released its annual ranking of city charter schools recently, and it concluded that a third of the schools it sponsors are in the top performing category, five more than last year. Is DC doing charter accountability right?
So I think once again, this shows that schools need to be held accountable for results. And really the focus needs to be on the lowest performing schools to make sure that they're closed down. And, you know, these are schools where if you're using multiple years to evaluate the schools in question, that's a significant portion of a child's career in schools. And that's not fair for that child to be sitting around year after year while a bad school is kept open.
Well, DC also, because the charter schools have such a high market share, you really do have this essence of competition where when you have this information available to all parents about how students are doing in the schools, that there really is a lot of mobility between the charters and the public schools, and parents have a lot of options. And then you take that coupled with a fairly centralized accountability system where you have a single authorizer, and then the authorizer is making sure is the one holding the schools accountable. And I think in that sense, you have a fairly robust system. You can compare that to a state like Ohio, where you have multiple authorizers. And then there's an extra step between an extra accountability step that the authorizer is responsible for the school accountability, and then the state is responsible for authorizer accountability, kind of. They're working on that. And so I think you get this really fragmented system where no one is entirely sure what a high quality school looks like, that you have schools that kind of fall through the cracks. And, you know, if DC is accountability done right, then Ohio is a system where we'll say there's room for improvement in their accountability system.
Absolutely. And I think the key word to use there is market, though, because there needs to be more market forces put to bear on our education system. And charter schools get at that a little bit. And I think some of the problems are when you have ill-informed consumers and you have really limited options or options that don't really represent a true free market where parents can kind of maybe not put their money, but put the money allocated to their child with their children and allow it to go to the best option possible.
An excellent point. And finally, question number three.
On Wednesday morning, Representative George Miller and Senator Tom Harkin introduced legislation to expand access to pre-K programs for four-year-olds. Does this bill largely resemble the president's pre-K proposal from the State of the Union? And what are the odds that it will pass?
It's not going to pass. I think we can start there. I think the Obama administration is looking for something happy to talk about. They haven't been able to talk about anything positive, even though maybe they were winning in the government shutdown. They've been doing a lot of losing, and even when they're winning, it's kind of nasty, and no one really likes what's going on. So I think they're looking for something positive to talk about, maybe set themselves up for the next go around and see if it can pass then, but I'm not seeing it.
What do you think are the deal killer provisions, or is it just the entire idea of an Obama sponsored bill?
Well, first and foremost, I don't think
Obama supported bill. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it is pretty similar to what the president proposed in the State of the Union with some differences. But I think the bottom line is there's not a real clear funding stream. And so you're looking at either increased spending or increased taxes or both. I think to get this through the Republican controlled House, you're probably going to need to figure out what you're trading off. So, okay, you're increasing spending on this because it's a priority. What are you cutting to offset it?
Well, what do you think about the idea of raising taxes to offset those costs and specifically raising them on something that is not related to education, like tobacco?
Yeah, it's probably the most politically correct funding stream they could find was a tobacco tax. And, you know, you can only do that for so long. Tobacco taxes have been used for all sorts of purposes that have nothing to do with, you know, really what they should be used for. And state settlements and all the rest were used for pretty much plugging budget holes in a lot of cases. And, you know, really just the idea of raising a tax period is going to be a problem.
Well, thank you for that. And I believe that is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Now, please join me in welcoming everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dara.
So are you one of these early Christmas shoppers, get everything done on your list even before Thanksgiving, or last minute?
Very last minute. Always have been. I mean, I actually kind of like the last minute thing. I get kind of caught up in the excitement of it. And I know a lot of people don't think it's fun to, you know, walk 2 miles from your faraway parking spot into the mall with, you know, throngs and throngs of people. But I get jazzed about that. It just like it makes it festive.
So you're not even like a Black Friday shopper. You're a day before Christmas shopper.
I'm like, give me 3 or 4 days and my list and I can knock it all out.
But you make the list.
I do have a list. I'm not one of these people that's going to wander around from shop to shop not knowing what I want. I actually am very, that's a good point. I'm very thoughtful ahead of time to like ask, I ask for a Christmas list for my friends and family. And then I know what I'm after and it's much more efficient.
Efficiency is definitely key when you're dealing with 8 million last minute Christmas shoppers.
Problem is I end up wrapping presents Christmas morning, which is really not that fun. But anywho, that's how I like it.
Well, you have now 6 weeks to worry about it. What do you have for us this week?
A new study out by MDRC examines the impact of Success for All, which is an early reading intervention that was one of the first recipients of an I3 grant. I usually do not do program evaluations on the Research Minute just because I just think some of them are just kind of in the weeds and they can be not so exciting. But Success for All has been around forever, like 30 years. It received one of the first scale-up I3 grants because it had a prior record of impact. So it was kind of caught my attention. It emphasizes, for those who don't know, explicit phonics instruction, highly scripted curriculum, which some teachers love and some teachers hate. It's a cross grade ability grouping, which is key. So we're not going to worry about putting, you know, your second graders and your third graders together, your kindergartners, your first graders, and routine regrouping. So in other words, as soon as the kid shows mastery in a particular area, he or she gets grouped with other students to sort of build on that mastery. The other key component of it is lots of tutoring for kids who are struggling, which some schools have a hard time implementing because of the staffing model. Regardless, this is the first report that's key, comprises a $6.7 million evaluation. So, wow, this thing better be a great evaluation. 19 K-5 and K-6 participating schools in 4 states are randomly selected to launch the program in 2011-2012. They're compared to 18 control group schools. Importantly, the evaluation included an implementation measure, and all schools were found to have met satisfactory implementation levels as determined by Success for All. That's key, right? Because they knew these schools were following the program. Bottom line, SFA schools scored significantly better, higher than the control group on 1 of 2 standardized measures for kindergarten, and it held across subgroups. So minority kids, poor kids, they just kept seeing that that higher impact. These kids also did better applying phonics and decoding skills to nonsense words than the control kids. But both groups scored similarly on letter word identification. Some other findings I thought were just noteworthy. Teachers in the SFA schools received more PD in reading than the control schools. Makes sense. Reported doing more cross-grade ability grouping and regrouping, which are obviously hallmarks of the model. But the same things for both groups, which I thought were also interesting. They both spent about the same time on instruction, about 104 minutes, I think. So, I mean, they got the same amount of time. They're just doing vastly different things with that time. They both rated their principals pretty high, and their schools are similarly, rather. And they both reported using data to check student progress. The one different thing that was in terms of the teacher reports is that the SFA teacher spent more time on comprehension and vocabulary. Control schools, guess what control schools were emphasizing more?
Spelling. Hey.
Wow, how'd you get that? Good job. Spelling. So that kind of makes me cringe a little bit, but that was one of the big differences. I mean, bottom line is it's pretty encouraging, right? I mean, it should be because Success for All has been around forever. It's gotten a lot of support. It's getting all this money now, but it carries a hefty price tag, which has always been the complaint about Success for All, and it doesn't look like it's gotten any cheaper. I started poking around the website, and if you agree to participate in the I3 grant, it still costs $104 per child per year.
Ouch.
Yeah, that adds up quickly.
Well, you'd hope that perhaps there's takeaways that teachers and schools can learn from this, that perhaps they can train their peers and you don't have to enroll all the time, or you bring your instructional practices to a new school. I mean, as a math teacher, it's an incredibly difficult task to teach a first grader to read. And, you know, the sheer amount of research that has gone into this, this is not something that, you know, somebody just pulled out of their pocket and said, hey, let's try it. You know, it's definitely worth the investment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, right? I mean, there are all these various sort of phonics-based approaches that the, you know, the National Reading Panel pulled on when Reading First, you know, came out, and it pulled on some of the work that Success for All had already done, you know, in the 80s. So this is good stuff, yeah, but the question in my mind, right, is can the same sort of components of Success for All be implemented without the hefty price tag? I mean, the big price tag in my mind is the tutoring, because I mean, having taught before and knowing a little bit about this model, a lot of times they want one-on-one tutoring with the kid, not even group, but one-on-one. So that's a huge staffing investment, and that's something that Success for All has not backed down on. They say that is part of our component, part of our program.
Could there be a parent training aspect of this, mm-hmm. where you know the you hear all the time that kids learn to read at home. They learn math in school. They learn to read at home. Mm-hmm. So perhaps districts might consider integrating a parent training component, right. so that the parents can help serve as the tutors, and that might lower the cost.
That's right. It's a great point. And let's not forget, not that everything's got to be about the Common Core around here, but there are a lot of great videos that now demonstrate, okay, this is what your child should be able to do in reading if they're going to be on track to master the skills and you know, knowledge required in the Common Core. And so they should know X number of sight words, you know, by the end of first grade. And something like that is really measurable. And I agree, it's something that parents can participate in terms of teaching their child how to read. So you think that some of this, you know, good Common Core tools and resources that are out there can build upon this research.
Well, thanks for that. And we're looking forward to new strategies to helping our kids learn to read, yes. or expansion of tried and true ones.
Right. That may be less expensive.
Until next week.
I'm Michael Brickman.
And I'm Darizy Handler for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.